I've written a column in the latest Issues Etc. journal titled Confessions of a Well-Intentioned Preacher. It details how I mistakenly ignored or explained away entire parts of Scripture in order to protect my hearers from legalism. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Lyman Stone writes about the certainty he found in the presence of Christ in his word and sacraments. The free online Issues Etc. journal. They could be writing today with ever-breaking news about a priestly sex scandal that is now dragged on into its, well, going into its third decade, early in its third decade. Of course, the history goes back much farther than that, but the scandal as it broke upon us about 20 years ago and continues to do so, even with new revelations about D.C. Archbishop and his past of sexual abuse of young boys and young men, the Lutheran Reformers could easily have been writing about this situation. They took up a subject, the marriage of priests, and one of their biggest objections to enforced and permanent celibacy, as they referred to it, was that it led to all kinds of abuse. It led to all kinds of, they won't even mention the names of things that it led to, but we can read between the lines and realize they were talking about situations not unlike the ones that sadly have plagued the Roman Catholic Church worldwide over the last decades. So is celibacy the problem? What were their theological objections to enforced and permanent celibacy of priests? Part of it had to do with what it did to the church's teaching on marriage. We'll be talking about all of that as we continue our series on the Lutheran Confessions. Today, part 14, discussing the Apology of the Augsburg Confession. We'll talk about the marriage of priests and get started on the subject of the Mass. Pastor Paul McCain joins us. He's publisher and executive director of editorial for Concordia Publishing House based in St. Louis. He's general editor of Concordia, the Lutheran Confessions. Paul, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Good to be with you again, Todd.
Well, today is a big day. At least for Lutherans it is. It's June 25th, which is the anniversary of the presentation of the Augsburg Confession. We're walking through the Apology to the Augsburg Confession. The Augsburg Confession is often referred to as the Magna Carta of the Reformation. If the Augsburg Confession is the Magna Carta, then what is the Apology of the Augsburg Confession?
Yeah, I was alerted you might be asking me that question, and it struck me, if we want to kind of do that, we could say that the Augsburg Confession was the Declaration of Independence and the Apology is the Constitution. It is kind of amusing how we Lutherans seem to have a tendency to say something and then say it a lot more in more depth. We've got this with the Small and Large Catechism, the Augsburg Confession, and the Apology, the epitome of the Formula of Concord, which is a summary, and then the Solid Declaration, which is the whole thing. Yeah, this is, in some ways, and well, not just in some ways, but frankly, today is the birthday of the Lutheran Church. It really, arguably, did not really exist as a definite thing until they gathered, the Lutheran princes and electors all stood up to the emperor and said, here's what we believe, here's our bottom line, we're not going to change, do what you will, but now we are who we are. So in many ways, this is the birthday of our Lutheran Church and confession.
We're going to be dealing with the issue of the marriage of priests, and it seems somewhat timely. There has been, for the last almost three decades, I think it's usually referred to as the priestly abuse scandal in the Roman Catholic Church. It's bled over into other confessions of faith as well. Certainly not unique to Roman Catholicism, but it has been the kind of boilerplate response that required celibacy of priests has nothing to do with this. That has always sounded a bit fishy to me, and while we want to uphold celibacy as a godly institution, a gift of God that God gives to some, it seems as though the Reformers don't have a very high view of the way it was being practiced among the Roman Catholic priests. They call it their filthy celibacy. What are they talking about?
Well, it is very interesting. Some people you know, just like I do with the Bible, say, what does it say in the Book of Concord that homosexuality is a sin? It is in this article that you have some of the most explicit remarks pointing us directly to the problem here is homosexuality, as it is in the so-called child abuse scandal in the Roman Church. Many, many studies, and people can just look this up for themselves online. The reason I feel pretty well prepared to speak to this issue is that when I was working as an assistant to the president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, our own synod went through its time where, frankly, we didn't do a good enough job handling guys who would have adulterous affairs or even, in some cases, a true child abuse. So I really studied these issues and watched the Roman Catholic Church come to terms with this. And finally, what forced the church to come to terms with it is all the horrendous legal settlements with a lot of money involved. I hate to say it that way, but it's that got everybody's attention, as it did our church as well. But at the base of it, we have to understand this forced celibacy, telling a man that he is not to engage in, as it's described, the natural desires that God has created in all of us, men and women, and instead must take on this vow of celibacy. And it ends up in, the great scandal. If you look in paragraph 2, they refer to it as this public scandal of criminal and unnatural lust. Most things done with the greatest license by these men cannot even be named without a breach of modesty. That is a direct reference to homosexuality. And sorry, back to my point. It's not really a matter of children being abused in the Catholic Church as much as it is prepubescent and pubescent young boys, young men. These male priests are going after them, and it's been proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that the Roman Catholic celibate priesthood has provided a haven for homosexuals. It's been well known for years. It was known at this time. This is directly what it's talking about. Men join the priesthood because they're conflicted about their homosexuality, and they think, if I'm forced to live a celibate life, I will be able to avoid acting out on the temptations of homosexuality in my life, and so I'm going to join the Roman Catholic priesthood. Now, fortunately, and I don't think many people realize this, the Vatican, and this has been now for over 10 years, has made it very clear they will no longer admit to any of their seminaries a man who is struggling with homosexual temptation. Now, that's something we haven't even done as a church body, which I believe we absolutely should. You're just setting up a man for problems when you place him in this very stressful office of public service in the church, and then on top of it, if he's a homosexual, he's still dealing with all these temptations. It's just a recipe for absolute disaster, and that's exactly what this article is talking about then, and it's directly applicable to today.
Could you just give us a brief, and it kind of needs to be brief because the history is so long and so convoluted, how they got to the point in medieval Roman Catholicism where celibacy was a requirement for the priesthood?
Well, in the early church, and some of this, honestly, you're right, it could be a very long conversation, the influence of Roman spirituality, by Roman I mean the Empire of Rome, there was latent in Roman culture this view that the highest way of life could be achieved by being celibate. They had the Temple of the Vestal Virgins in Rome, and this was considered one of their holiest institutions, and these women were all virgins, and I mean, the kind of laws and requirements of them sound very much like what the Roman Church required eventually of its clergy. But the institution of a mandated celibacy didn't happen until many, many hundreds of years into the history of the church, where then it became a part of canon law. Even though chastity, celibacy, virginity were praised in the early church, in many ways wrongly so, as you know, you see the seeds of these teachings taking root, that if someone remains unmarried, that they are somehow spiritually living on a higher plane than people who are married. And this bore its full fruit in the full flowering of institutionalized, mandated, legalized priestly celibacy, something that, you know, the Eastern Church has never imposed on its priests, even though to be a bishop in the Eastern Church, you must be an unmarried man. Or if your wife dies, you cannot remarry, as things like that. But in the Roman Church, this is unique to the Roman communion in the Roman Church. And one irritating thing you'll often hear Roman Catholics say is, oh no, it's not mandated across the whole church because the Eastern Rite Roman Catholics can take wives. Well, come on. I mean, this is just ridiculous. So, again, this history, you know, what became a valued virtue became an instituted requirement for all men as they enter the priesthood must agree never to be married or to have any kind of sexual relationships.
They say in paragraph 6 of the law requiring celibacy, they say that it conflicts with divine and natural law, disagrees with the very canons and councils of the church. It's clearly superstitious and dangerous. What are they talking about there?
Well, again, this is back to the issue. When you impose a lifestyle on a person who does not have the special gift of celibacy, which we do acknowledge in this article that it is a gift from God. Only those who are given this gift can be chaste, unmarried, I should say, remain unmarried and free from sexual temptation. That's, you know, when you mandate it, then all these scandals happen. They had scandals then. You can read some of the medieval heads of specific monasteries writing at length, warning the men in their monasteries against homosexuality and sodomy and all kinds of just horrible stuff. This is why, I mean, it makes me embarrassed to have to talk about it, and that's why they say right away, we really can't talk about all this in great detail without committing a breach of modesty. I mean, St. Paul says the same thing in the New Testament, you know, things we don't even want to talk about. And obviously, it's referring to homosexual behaviors. Could also involve child abuse and pederasty. And, you know, the Roman culture, while at the same time holding high these Vestal virgins, kind of winked an eye at men who would take boys to themselves. This was a part of Greek culture. Even in the great warrior city of Sparta, it was common practice for older warriors to take under their wings young men. This was not viewed as something perverse, which of course it is.
Was there an attendant denigration of marriage with the elevation of celibacy?
Yeah, absolutely. This article, like all the rest, touches on the chief article of the faith, that you make a certain behavior or a choice to not be married, which is a God-ordained, God-pleasing institution, set in place in Genesis 1 right away, you make that into a lower calling in life, and the higher calling becomes one in which you can merit God's favor by taking on these additional burdens, denying what God has created in you. So yes, this all gets back again to the article of justification. Are we saved by works, or are we saved by grace through faith alone? And of course, the answer the Bible gives is by grace through faith alone, that marriage is not a second-class institution in the church. In fact, Luther elsewhere in the Lutheran Confessions goes on at length about how the institution of marriage and the family is the highest office in the church, even above that of the office of the pastoral ministry.
Talking with Pastor Paul McCain, publisher and executive director of editorial for Concordia Publishing House, our series on the Lutheran Confessions. We're in the Apology of the Augsburg Confession, talking about the marriage of priests. We'll make the case for the marriage of priests after this.
We Lutherans were never aided by following along with some other tradition's theological priorities and catchphrases.
Issues Etc. regular guest, Pastor Heath Curtis, coordinator for stewardship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod on a Lutheran approach to stewardship.
Other folks are not approaching it from our good, solid Lutheran understanding of law and gospel and vocation. There's a place to talk about this in Christianity, and we have a way of talking about stewardship as Lutherans without ever using the word stewardship, if you like. I'm going to talk to you today about your vocation in your home, in your church, in your society, and how each one of these makes a claim on you, on your presence, on your support, on your prayers. That's how we should talk about this as Lutherans.
You'll find several stewardship resources at lcms.org/stewardship, lcms.org/stewardship.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Emmanuel means God with us. God is with us at Emmanuel Lutheran Church and School at 1285 Main Street in Hamilton, Ohio, near Cincinnati. God is with us as we gather on Sunday at 8 and 10:45 a.m. for divine service. God with us in his word of forgiveness, with us in the waters of baptism, with us in the body and blood of Christ in Holy Communion, with us in the classrooms of our school and child care, serving children from age 3 to 8th grade. Join us for worship or enroll your child in our Christ-centered day school. Find us at emmanuelhamilton.com.
O Lord, open my lips.
And my mouth will
Listen to chapel services live, weekday mornings from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Morning chapel from Kramer Chapel. Live, weekday mornings at 8:30 Central, 9:30 Eastern, 7:30 Mountain, and 6:30 Pacific at issuesetc.org.
The Lord bless us, defend us from all evil, and bring us to everlasting life.
Amen.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the marriage of priests in the Apology of the Augsburg Confession, our series on the Lutheran Confessions. Pastor Paul McCain is our guest, publisher and executive director of editorial for Concordia Publishing House based in St. Louis and general editor of Concordia, the Lutheran Confessions. Issues Etc. guest Lyman Stone has written about his journey to Lutheranism in the Wittenberg Trail feature of the Issues Etc. journal. It's titled From Despair to the Real Presence of God. He talks about what it was like growing up in a Christianity that had no real teaching or practice on the means of grace. You can read it for yourself and subscribe absolutely free at our website, issuesetc.org. Click the red button on the right-hand side of the page. Enter your email address and we will send you absolutely free the online Issues Etc. journal. Paul, in addition to making the case against enforced and permanent celibacy among the priests, the Reformers also want to make the case for the marriage of priests. How do they do it?
Well, it all goes back to this, that there's absolutely no connection between God's call to the ministry and God's, at the same time, telling people you can't get married. That just does not exist in the Bible. All human beings are, unless they are given a special gift, they are all hardwired to desire one another. As they say in paragraph 7, Genesis 1:28 teaches that people were created to be fruitful. One sex should desire the other in a proper way. And again, they say we're not talking about lustful desire, which is sin, but that appetite that was in nature in its perfection. In other words, Adam and Eve were of one flesh before the fall into sin. It's not, and here we do have to fault some of the early church fathers for almost describing any kind of sexual activity between two people, married or not, as being innately sinful. There is some latent tendencies there, which again gave full fruit during the Middle Ages. But, and then this, in paragraph 7, it says, this ordinance of God cannot be removed without an extraordinary work of God. And that's what they're talking, a person who is truly celibate has this extraordinary gift, this extraordinary gift, to pronounce it for understanding's sake. Everybody is under the commandment to reproduce, to populate the earth, and we were all created to desire the other sex.
Now, when they begin to talk about marriage in this sense, they kind of start a logical argument, I think 5 or 6 points in their argument. But they want to respond, firstly, to the kind of popular objection that they're getting when they talk about the marriage of priests and marriage as a general institution among mankind. They say, okay, the opponents are going to say, when the command was first given, be fruitful and multiply. It was given so as to populate the earth, but now that the earth is populated, as they say, marriage is no longer commanded.
Well, yeah, that's ridiculous. And I have to say, in fairness to the Roman Church today, they don't even run with that argument anymore. Rome has definitely changed its rhetoric on these issues, and it has put much more value on the vocation of being a parent, a husband and wife, than it did at this time. So, I mean, we have to be fair about it. That is absolutely the case now with the Roman Catholic Church.
The point they want to make here, second, is that because this creation or this divine ordinance, speaking here about marriage, in humanity is a natural right, they say natural right is unchangeable. Is this their way of talking about natural law?
Oh, absolutely. And this was a, even though the Roman Church disagreed with the application of the doctrine of natural law, in this case, they also embrace the idea of natural law. But here it's a very strong case for defending the marriage of priests, that a man has every right by God's creation, call it natural law if you will, and the real point is where they say, where nature does not change, that ordinance which God gave, nature does not change. And, of course, every argument used here to defend marriage can also be used to oppose the imposition of so-called gay marriage, which is actually no such thing, and homosexuality, which is a complete breach of natural law and completely contrary to it. So telling guys you can't get married is a breach of natural law. Telling people homosexuality is now okay, that's a breach of natural law. We cannot remove what God has created. And that's why they say it's ridiculous for the adversaries to babble that marriage was commanded at the beginning, but now is not anymore.
I think they are also responding in part, as they have already, to this confusion that the adversaries want to make between the natural desire of male and female for one another and lustful desires. But they have a very clever response to that. They say, look, marriage isn't a product of the lustful desires. It's the cure for those things.
Well, this is exactly Paul's point when he talks about marriage. And he says very, very bluntly, if you find in yourself you cannot resist these natural urges and are being led into sin because of them, the remedy is marriage. Now, that's not to say, and I've heard people say this, you know, well, just run out and get married so you can have all the sex you want. Well, come on now. That's not what we're saying either. But within this loving, fruitful relationship, there is a natural God-created, I don't even know if I should use the word natural. It's God-ordained. It's a God's created remedy for people to live out their lives in a God-pleasing way using God's gift of their nature as man and woman.
They continue that argument in their third point, saying, Paul says, because the temptation to sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife. They're quoting there from 1 Corinthians 7. This is a clear command having to do with everyone unfit for celibacy. This is not going to sit well with some of our listeners here, Paul. But they speak here of marriage as a command unless you have the gift of celibacy.
Yes, I mean, there really is no room to make the assertion that I'm unmarried by choice if, in fact, you still have these God-ordained, God-created natural urges towards women. You know, why would you put yourself in that situation? If you're not given, as they point out right here, if you are not given this special gift of chastity, and here we must also qualify even that expression, marriages are to be chaste. Luther says that we live chaste and decent lives in what we say and do in the small catechism. Once you get married, you're not exempt from that either. In other words, just because you're married doesn't mean you can indulge in every kind of vile, whatever kind of vile behaviors you want. Oh, we're married, it doesn't matter. No, even within marriage, where do you use this gift in a chaste and decent way?
Then they say here, this is paragraph 18. Here the adversary's command, seeking chastity from God, weakening the body through labor and hunger. Why do they not proclaim these magnificent commandments to themselves? As we have said before, the adversaries are only playing. They are doing nothing seriously. What particular argument of the adversaries are they addressing there?
Well, the idea that if you're going to take on these vows of remaining unmarried and free from any kind of sexual activity and you're calling into the ministry, then, well, you've got to subject yourself to all kinds of, bodily disciplines. And again, behind the scenes here, you almost can hear Luther whispering in Melanchthon's ear describing what he went through in the monasteries and what people would put themselves through to try to suppress what is a perfectly good created thing in them, but trying to suppress it. And then they say in paragraph 19, if chastity were possible to all, it would not require a particular gift or a peculiar gift. And the Bible makes it very clear, as St. Paul says in some of his same places where he talks about marriage, that it is possible to have this gift of chastity, but that's only a very, very few. Not everyone has it. And then they go on to say, God wishes the rest to use, and here, pretty good, pretty close to saying natural law, God wishes the rest to use the common law of nature which he has instituted.
It's not a popular idea today, especially among Lutherans. There's been a little bit of debate among us lately about the fertility rate. It's related to the notion of marriage. Obviously, Lutherans are like almost everyone else in American culture. They put marriage off until all the other boxes of their bucket list have been ticked in their lives in some cases. How do you think the Reformers would deal with that following of a societal trend by their theological descendants?
Well, I think there's no question that say whatever you want about it or debate all you want about it. The fact of the matter is that to suppress these natural urges to say, well, I'm going to put off marriage until I'm in just the right place in my life to do it, that really has no biblical command, example, or promise. Again, which are the three litmus tests for what is biblical and what is not. This idea that, you know, we should delay marriage until a very long time and then put off having children for a very long time and then avoid having children as God gives them, it just doesn't hold up to a scrutiny of the Holy Scriptures and God's institution and command.
At the very end of that point in paragraph 25, they kind of tip their hand regarding an argument that was made later in the Reformation in the Treatise on the Power and Primacy of the Pope as to a pretty dire accusation against their opponents. They say, therefore, this law about permanent celibacy is particular to this new pontifical tyranny, nor is it without reason that Daniel 11:37 attributes this mark to the kingdom of the Antichrist, hatred for women. They're going to pick that up again when they take up the issue of the papacy, aren't they?
Well, sure. This is one of the marks of Antichrist, that they forbid being given in marriage or taking marriage. It's right there. I mean, it's dramatic how this very issue is one that really exposes how corrupt Rome has become with their theology, and frankly still is. And it's just very fascinating to watch what's going on now in the Vatican. It's been well documented in the Vatican there are these gangs of homosexuals, and again, it's all because they view this institution of priestly celibacy as some kind of a haven from their desires, when in fact it becomes a breeding ground for them. And the Pope is beginning to wonder, well, you know, we can't seem to be attracting enough men to the priesthood. What should we do? You know, some people are saying, well, he should just open it up to women. Others of us have been saying for a long time, maybe they're finally going to drop this nonsense and allow their priests to get married, as they were in the beginning. St. Peter himself, as they claim, the first pope, was married. He had a mother-in-law. Jesus healed Peter's mother-in-law. So this is just all, this is one of the most stupid things the Roman Church does. I mean, just on the base of it. I can explain a lot of it. I can understand a lot of it. This is one I never been able to wrap my head around. Why would they burden themselves with this?
Pastor Paul McCain is our guest. We're studying the Lutheran Confessions in an ongoing series with him. We're in the Apology of the Augsburg Confession, talking about the marriage of priests. When we come back, they say that it also violates the ancient canons of the church. Right now, many churches are planning their budgets for the next fiscal year. You can promote your confessional Lutheran church and support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by joining our congregational sponsorship program, the Issues Etc. 300. We're looking for 300 congregations to include $1,000 in their mission or advertising budgets. You'll find an informational flyer on the support page at issuesetc.org. Don't miss your congregation's budget deadline. The Issues Etc. 300.
40 Years Greatly Blessed is this year's theme at Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois. We engage young adults in a Christ-centered environment and provide an alternative to secular public high schools. Please help us provide tuition assistance to more students by making a special 40th anniversary tax-deductible gift at melhs.org and click on the giving page, or call me, Dr. J. Krause, principal, at 618-656-0043.
Whether you're a man yourself or a woman who cares about the men in your life, you won't want to miss the June issue of The Lutheran Witness. Join John Kleinig, Hans Feeney, Jeffrey Hammer, Broer Erickson, and others in this power-packed issue on men at church as they explore toxic masculinity, godly fatherhood, the religious gender gap, and more. Subscribe today at cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness. Interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.
Did you know that we send out an email each week that details upcoming show topics? It's available for you to include in your weekly church bulletin. Just click the Issues Etc. Journal logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, and sign up to receive the church bulletin blurb. It's an easy way to invite your fellow parishioners to listen to Issues Etc. issuesetc.org. Look for the Issues Etc. Journal logo and register to receive a weekly bulletin paragraph from Issues Etc.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
You could win an audio DVD of every presentation from all six Issues Etc. Making the Case conferences. Record your answer to the question, Issues Etc. What does this mean? On our comment line, 618-223-8382. If we play your answer during Issues Etc., we'll send you a conference audio DVD of almost 50 hours of teaching. 618-223-8382 and answer the question, Issues Etc., what does this mean? Please be sure to mention where you listen.
Children are a heritage from the Lord, but what of those who've not been given the gift of a child? The cross of barrenness affects not only childless couples, it affects the family, friends, and pastors who love and care for them. I'm Katie Schuerman, and I'm partnering with Emmanuel Press to publish the second edition of my book, He Remembers the Barren, a story about the hope and contentment found only in Christ, no matter the cross we bear. Visit emmanuelpress.us to learn more. emmanuelpress.us.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Monday afternoon, June the 25th, we are continuing our series on the Lutheran Confessions in the Apology of the Augsburg Confession, talking about the marriage of priests. In a few minutes, we'll turn to the subject of the Mass. The Reformers are also wanting to point out, and I think we heard a little bit of this just a few minutes ago, Paul, that forbidding marriage is not supported by the ancient canons of the Church. What are they talking about there?
Some of the very first church councils that dealt with all kinds of issues, just trying to organize and govern the church, talked about how the priest should deal with his wife and things like that. It was just said in such a way in the earliest records of some of these earliest councils and decrees of the various councils of the ecumenical church at the time. Of course, priests had their wives. That was just common knowledge, and they had to deal with, you know, as we do today with our own pastors. We have rules and regulations about how pastors are to conduct themselves as married men and what the consequences are in terms of their continuing in the office of the ministry if they fail in those duties. Same in the early church. It's just this all arose, and again, it became a way to elevate a certain style of life above and beyond what God's Word ever says to make it appear that this is the highest life. In fact, as we wrap up our discussion of the Apology, we're going to deal with a whole section on monastic vows. Same problem. Instituting things that have never been commanded by God and trying to elevate them to the highest life. This is a way you really please God. This is a way you can earn extra merit. And what happens? You replace the gospel of Jesus, the free forgiveness of sins, with all these rules and regulations and requirements that have no biblical basis.
Their final point before they get into some stuff that I want to deal with here that's kind of philosophical, some reference to history that is lost to many of us. They say, finally, if they, the opponents, understand that celibacy is pure in the sense that it merits justification more than marriage does, we most forcefully deny it. That's the real issue for them, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Again, it clouds the doctrine of justification. Lay people are made to look to their priests as a representative of what it really means to be a Christian. Wow, that's really the highest life. If you join a religious order, if you become a monk or a nun or a priest, and these are the guys who are really, guys and gals, who are really living the super virtuous Christian life. And the only argument that the Roman Church makes that is absolutely biblical, and St. Paul says it, an unmarried man is anxious only about the things of the Lord. This is absolutely true. We should not disagree with them when they make a valid point. It is true that an unmarried man is freer, I'm quoting in paragraph 40, freer and less distracted by domestic occupations in praying, teaching, and serving. So of all the points they make, we'll concede that one. Why? Because St. Paul says it in 1 Corinthians 7:32. But that does not defend mandated virginity for the sake of the priesthood.
They have a conclusion here in paragraph 60 where if they hadn't said enough about it already, I mean, they have had a lot to say about the marriage of priests and why marriage is a good institution. They say, we have explained why we cannot with a good conscience agree with the adversaries when they defend the pontifical law about permanent celibacy. It conflicts with divine and natural law. It varies from the canons themselves. It is superstitious and full of danger. And finally, the whole affair is insincere. What are they talking about?
Well, they talk a great game, but again, the reality of how this worked out in the monasteries and in the priesthood, first of all, you have to understand, it was well known that most parish priests during the High Middle Ages had concubines, had mistresses, or de facto wives. This was just well known. The popes themselves, there are many examples of popes who had children. So it was almost a joke. I mean, people just winked an eye, oh, well, you know. So the whole thing with this is a sham. Now, one thing we can say with a huge worldwide public exposure to these long-standing problems in the Roman Catholic priesthood, perhaps now there is a much greater sensitivity, but we keep hearing about new stories pop up. This guy in Washington, who is one of the Vatican diplomats, was looking at child porn, and the United States wanted the Vatican to allow him to be arrested and tried according to the laws of the United States. He probably would have been sent to prison for life or for a very long time. Instead, the Vatican refused, claiming diplomatic immunity, and the guy went back to Rome, and recently he was sentenced to 5 years in prison. I guess there's a prison in the Vatican. I don't know. I don't know what he's going to do. But the point of it is, it was and is a false doctrine then. It was a sham. It wasn't followed consistently, and it's the same today.
I think that's enough said there, Paul, about the marriage of priests. It's pretty clear that if the Reformers were speaking, and as they are in the Book of Concord, to us today, they would be advocates of the abolition of enforced celibacy, and they would be great advocates of allowing priests to marry, which might solve a lot of problems in a practical sense.
One of the best summary lines is paragraph 40, first sentence. The adversaries defend the law that is godless and destructed the good morals by such false arguments. True then, true now.
Now we turn to probably one of the biggest issues facing the Lutherans as they're dealing with their opponents in Roman Catholicism, and that is the Mass. Let's begin it this way. How did the average parishioner, devout Catholic, practicing Catholic, in medieval Roman Catholicism at the time of the Reformation, how did they experience what is referred to here as the Mass?
That is a very good question. And we all tend to want to immediately jump to the big cities and giant cathedrals, but let's go in the opposite direction. Let's talk about the local parish, the very, very small, often very crudely built structure in which a priest, the parish priest, often highly uneducated man, would be standing in front of this altar, as simple as it would be. He would be babbling away in Latin and frankly probably not doing a very good job of reciting it accurately. The lay people would be standing there. There weren't pews at this time. Women and small children would be seated around the edge of the church. And they would just be listening to this and watching. It was kind of a spectator sport. I mean, the priest would go through the motions, literally all these very intricate prescribed rubrics, rules. He would elevate the elements, at which point people would fall on their knees. They'd worship Christ in the real presence under bread and wine. Nothing necessarily wrong with that, but they really didn't know what was going on. As often, their own priest couldn't even really explain what was going on well. And the Lutherans, Luther himself was shocked to the core when he visited the parishes around Wittenberg and found, as he described it, good God, what misery I beheld. I mean, priests who couldn't even recite the Ten Commandments, couldn't say the Lord's Prayer, didn't know what was going on theologically. It was a mess because everybody was doing all of this as a way to appease God. As long as we go through the motions, we are pleasing God. And the theory for this was the work that is worked. In other words, our actions, our work of offering to God the body and blood of his Son, again in the Mass, is earning for us God's grace. We are propitiating God through the activities of this Mass. So whether you actually receive the Lord's Supper yourself personally didn't matter as much. In fact, you could go to the local priest and sponsor Masses for your dead relatives. They would say the Mass to get people out of purgatory, where the churches were larger in larger communities, larger cities, villages like Wittenberg. The parish church in Wittenberg, St. Mary, had, you know, altars all along the walls. The castle church had a ton of altars where there would be a priest saying endowed Masses for the sake of people's dead relatives or for themselves. They completely turned the point of the Lord's Supper completely around, just 180 degrees in the wrong direction.
We're talking about the Apology of the Augsburg Confession and the Marriage of Priests. We've moved on to the Mass now, talking about some of the problems there. Would the average parishioner have received the Lord's Supper? We'll answer that question on the other side of the break. Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, prepares and forms future pastors and deaconesses who are faithful to God's Word as articulated in the Lutheran Confessions. And thanks to generous supporters, tuition for all incoming residential students in the upcoming academic year will be paid in full. Learn more at ctsfw.edu or call 1-800-481-2155. Forming servants in Jesus Christ who teach the faithful, reach the lost, and care for all. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. We'll be right back.
It is no sign of your intelligence to confirm that all religions are going up the same mountain. You have to deny the fundamental teachings of the religions of the world to come to that conclusion.
Craig Parton, author of the Issues Etc., Book of the Month, Religion on Trial, Cross-Examining Religious Truth Claims.
They may all be wrong, but do any of them ask to be tested by the canons of evidence used in the law, science, and history?
Learn more about Religion on Trial at issuesetc.org.
LCMS National Housing Corporation is the Lutheran Federal Credit Union Ministry of the Month. During June, if you open a Lutheran FCU loan to meet your financial needs, or if you use your Lutheran FCU credit card for a qualifying amount of purchases, Lutheran FCU will give you cash back and give that same amount of money to LCMS National Housing Corporation. Learn more at LutheranFCU.org. Lutheran Federal Credit Union. Good for you, good for the church. LutheranFCU.org.
Evangelical and Catholic. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Remember when education was about the fundamental skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic? And about reading great literature and studying history to give our kids a model for what it is to be a good person? Memoria Press's classical Christian curriculum offers that very model for your homeschool. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR17. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, a classical Christian education that works.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. On this Monday, June the 25th, our series on the Lutheran Confessions continues. We're in the Apology of the Augsburg Confession, and we're talking about the Mass. Just getting started, the majority of that conversation will take place in a future conversation with Pastor Paul McCain, General Editor of Concordia of the Lutheran Confessions. Again, by way of introduction, you were talking about the actual practice on the ground of medieval Roman Catholicism of the Mass. Would the average parishioner have actually received the Lord's Supper, Paul?
Well, honestly, it didn't matter. As long as you were witnessing, the very act of hearing a Mass was itself a good work. And the church had to mandate that people take communion on the major festival days of the church at least 4 times a year. So that's why, unfortunately, Luther was quoted once as saying, well, if you don't take communion at least 4 times, you shouldn't consider yourself a Christian. The church had mandated that it be received at least twice a year, but certainly on Easter. But that's an indication of how few people were actually receiving the consecrated elements. Most were just standing there, literally walking in and out of the church doing who knows what, while in a larger church, you would have the man up front in beautiful vestments blathering away in Latin, which you could barely even hear. And some of the Mass was said sub voco, almost under the breath, like the words of institution were not loudly proclaimed. That's why they had to ring bells to let the lay people know, okay, this is a point of the service where you need to kneel because now the hocus pocus is going on. And I use that phrase, hocus pocus, because that very phrase itself derives from the Latin words, hoc est corpus meum, this is my body, hocus pocus. I mean, that's how bad it got. And the reformers are much more aware of what was actually going on than we possibly even can be today. Now, again, I want to be fair. In the Roman Church today, particularly in the United States and the quote-unquote more westernized or advanced churches, they are now saying the Mass in the local languages. So if you go to a Roman church today, you will hear the whole thing in English. You will be able to hear it. There are some exceptions. Some parishes, like we've got one close to us at CPH, just down the road a bit, they are allowed to continue saying the Tridentine Latin Mass. And in those situations, I would hazard to guess most of the lay people actually do know what's being said. So Rome has really changed when it comes to how the Mass is done in their parishes. But at this time, now the theology hasn't changed, but the way it's presented, people can definitely now go and hear and understand what's being said.
So from the parishioner's side, it was superstition, kind of a vague superstition about what they might be receiving by simply observing or hearing a Mass being said.
Well, you know, and I don't want to be completely closed-minded to the possibility that there was some adequate catechization, at least in what the Roman Church taught. But the bottom line, and here maybe I'm jumping ahead too far, but in paragraph 9, they get to the real point. The Mass bestows grace by the outward act, and there's that Latin phrase, ex opere operato, or that when it's applied on behalf of others, it merits the forgiveness of venial and mortal sins, of guilt and punishment for them. So they turn the Lord's Supper, the observance, that's what the Mass is, the observance of the Lord's Supper in the context of a worship service. Okay? They turn Christ's gift of the Lord's Supper as his gracious giving of himself to us for the forgiveness of sins as we receive the consecrated bread and wine. They turn that into a human activity by which we do what we can to propitiate God simply by the outward activity of doing it. And the Roman Church taught then and still teaches now that these endowed Masses, people who pay to have Masses said, the work the priest is doing in the Mass can be applied on behalf of others, and they'll say this later, but not just others who are living, but even more significantly, for those in purgatory. Now, isn't it interesting? Here we are, almost at the end of the Apology, Article 24, the anniversary of the Augsburg Confession. What are we back to talking about again? As always, the whole Roman system of what repentance and true faith is all about. The more things change, the more they stay the same. The core doctrine of the Roman Church has been nuanced. It's presented in a much more winsome way. They talk about it's the re-presentation of the sacrifice of Christ. Okay, we could, you know, Jesus says, do this in remembrance of me. We do remember his sacrifice. But in the Roman Church, this re-presentation is still regarded as an act by which we can merit God's forgiving love and grace. So it becomes our work, not so much Christ's work for us.
That is why it's a little puzzling that, we will get to all of that in due course in our future conversations. It's a little puzzling that the first thing the Reformers say when they take up the issue of the Mass is, at the outset, we must again make this preliminary statement
We do not abolish the Mass, but religiously keep and defend it. Masses are celebrated among us every Lord's Day and on other festivals. What are they saying there?
Right. I alluded to it way too quickly, but it's probably, you're absolutely right, Todd. We need to, let's get our terms in place. The word Mass simply became a term, and they go on, they even explain where that word came from, but it simply became a shorthand for the service of the Lord's Supper, the institution of the elements, the distribution of them to communicants, the observance of what Christ instituted on the night in which he was betrayed. We don't abolish that. That's what they're talking about. We don't if that's all you mean by Mass, okay, and let's for a moment just start where they start. This is what the Mass really is, and we not only defend it, but we keep it even better than they do. And this was a known fact. The Lutheran Church, at the time of the Reformation, into the age of Lutheran Orthodoxy, the Lord's Supper was received far more frequently by lay people. The issue was not offering it. The Lord's Supper was always offered every Sunday. But how many people actually received it? That's the question. In the days of the High Middle Ages, very infrequently, but we have records of communion attendance in particularly larger cities like Leipzig. I mean, it was very common to receive the Lord's Supper very, very frequently. And we do that. We celebrate it every Lord's Day on every festival, just like the Roman Church does. And then they go on to say the sacrament is offered. This is a key comment. The sacrament is offered to those who wish to use it after they have been examined and absolved. And that, maybe we'll talk about it later, it completely destroys the notion of infant communion among us, but that's an aside at this point. So we're offering it at every Lord's Day on every festival.
They also want to say something about public ceremonies. And yep. They will come back to that several times, but they say, and the usual public ceremonies are observed, and the series of lessons, of prayers, vestments, and other such things. They will go on to say that ceremonies should be celebrated to teach the people. So if you were to walk into a Lutheran church at this time, and you were somewhat ignorant as to what you were seeing, could you mistake it for a Roman Catholic church?
Oh, you absolutely would. In fact, I forget which volume it's been in, but in Martin Breck's wonderful three-volume biography of Martin Luther, he actually reproduces a letter that I think it was probably a Calvinist wrote when they visited Wittenberg, and they went to the church service, and they said, oh my goodness, it's like the Reformation never happened. Well, you know, in their view, the Reformation meant you tear down all the images, you get rid of all the vestments, you get rid of the historic liturgy, on and on and on it goes. So yeah, no, it would be very easy to mistake a Lutheran communion service for a Roman communion service. Now, the informed listener would hear things not said that were said in the Roman Mass, but I've got a personal anecdote here, and I've probably told it before, but this really gobsmacked me when I was in the parish where it just so happened on the one Sunday I finally had worked up the nerve to chant as much of the liturgy as possible, including the words of institution, all in English, of course. At that very service, two things happened. Absolutely fascinating. One older member walked out and said, oh, Pastor, that was so beautiful. It reminded me of going to German church with Grandpa. I went, oh, well, that's interesting. In a Missouri Synod congregation. And then, about three people later, a lady walked out, I'm visiting my so-and-so, and I'm Roman Catholic, and I really enjoyed the Mass today, Father, because it sounded just like what we used to do before the Vatican II, only you said it all in English. And I thought, now, those are two very revealing, almost shocking comments, and that just shows how similar the perpetuation of the historic liturgy is in the Lutheran Church since the time of the Reformation.
We will take up more on the subject of the Mass with Pastor Paul McCain in a future conversation. There's much more to say about it in our study of the Apology of the Augsburg Confession. Pastor Paul McCain is publisher and executive director of editorial for Concordia Publishing House based in St. Louis. He is general editor of Concordia, the Lutheran Confessions. This is the Book of Concord that was published in 1580. It is the basis of Lutheran belief practice and confession, and will remain so until Christ returns. You can find out more about the Reader's Edition of Concordia, the Lutheran Confessions, and I highly recommend that you get it and you read it. If you're a Lutheran, it's a must read. And if you're interested in the Lutheran teaching, doctrine, and practice, it is also a must read. Find out more about it at our website, issuesetc.org. Call Concordia Publishing House. They have many editions they'd be happy to share with you. 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Paul, thanks for being our guest.
And happy Augsburg Confession Anniversary Day to you, Todd.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll have Pastor Tom Baker lead us in a Sunday school lesson on Ananias baptizing Saul. And we'll get a bio on 5th century Archbishop Cyril of Alexandria from Dr. Joel Olowski of Concordia Seminary. The Reformation, of course, is known more, or ought to be known more, for what it retained than what it abandoned. What did it abandon? Those things that obscured, or in some cases, like with the Mass, replaced the comfort of the gospel, but it retained everything else for the sake of that gospel. Up next on Lutheran Talk Radio 24/7, Pastor Paul McCann will be back. June 25th marks the 488th anniversary of the presentation of the Augsburg Confession, and we'll talk about this historic event with Pastor Paul McCann.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
In a world awash with all sorts of information, opinions, and ideas, there is still a place where God's Word is the central and only focus. Messiah Lutheran Church, 801 North Madison, Lebanon, Illinois. At 9 o'clock on Sunday mornings, God's people gather there to listen to Him. There you will find His words of law and gospel, and of course, our Lord's Holy Supper. Bible classes focus on the Bible and the Lutheran Confessions. Come, listen, believe, and live, and check out our website at messiahlebanon.org.
I've written a column in the latest Issues Etc. journal titled Confessions of a Well-Intentioned Preacher. It details how I mistakenly ignored or explained away entire parts of Scripture in order to protect my hearers from legalism. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Lyman Stone writes about the certainty he found in the presence of Christ in His Word and Sacraments, the free online Issues Etc. journal.